Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Roy Adroso about the right blogosphere's reaction to Donald Trump's flip-flop on Obama's birth certificate and other things. Then we'll be joined by Heather Digby Parton, another OG blogger and also a columnist for Salon, about Monday's big debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Should be interesting. And finally, we'll speak with David Turnbull from Oil Change International about a new report his group released about fossil fuel production and climate change this week. But first, a few items you may have missed. Barack Obama is fresh out of dams to give in a much ballyhooed exit interview with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Obama said that in his post-White House life, he would speak out on things in ways that he was institutionally constrained from doing as president. I predict that Obama will become his own anger translator, and that will be fun because Obama is already excellent at trolling the right. And I think he's going to be a very effective public speaker, public advocate, using his bully pulpit even after he is out of the White House. Donald Trump's campaign continues to take a toll on his brand, according to Bloomberg, and I quote, Trump's hotels, casinos, and golf courses in the U.S. saw their market share visits fall by 14% in July from a year earlier. The hardest hit venues were in New York and Chicago, while the drop-off was steepest among women in Democrat-leaning states. The Bloomberg article adds that, according to a website that caters to younger travelers, Trump's share of hotel bookings on its site fell 60% in a year. So that's the young kids are not going for Trump. Maybe prayer will help. This week, Trump appeared at an evangelical Christian event called the Midwest Vision and Values Pastors Leadership Conference. It's a mouthful, where one pastor told the audience that Trump is the victim of, and I quote, a concentrated satanic attack. Concentrated satanic attack. So that's not a diffuse satanic attack, or a watered down satanic attack. It's concentrated, like orange juice. Gotta mix it with water. At that point, the assembled laid hands on Trump in order to, and I quote again, give him the anointing to lead this nation. So this story, I should add, comes courtesy of Right Wing Watch. And there's been this running theme during the campaign of Trump traipsing to one evangelical event after another where he always looks bored and or really uncomfortable. But I guess that's the price of being the GOP nominee. He is also reportedly germ phobic. So having all these weirdos touching him must have been extra fun for the Donster. Finally, an odd and disturbing story out of Georgia. Sherry Hall was briefly a heroic police officer in Jackson, Georgia. She said that she had survived being shot by a scary black man. Thank God for her bulletproof vest, or she would have been a goner. And this set off a massive manhunt for the perpetrator. It set a community on edge, an entire community freaked out about the cop shooting black man at large. But this week, Sherry Hall was arrested on 4 felony counts, including tampering with evidence and giving false statements to investigators. It turns out that she made the whole story up. She just invented it out of whole cloth. Officials say she must have shot herself. Must have shot herself in the bulletproof vest. And while Sherry Hall may have had some weird motive that we can't understand, I just want to consider what kind of institutional culture there is in that department. When saying you were shot by a black suspect that you didn't apprehend can make you this kind of hero, and also consider how many black lives she endangered when she said that there was a potential cop killer out there at large on the streets of Jackson. Could have ended up a lot worse than it did, which is with Hall behind bars and nobody else hurt. And with that, let's move on with the show. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Roy Adroso. Stay tuned. Back. I'm still Joshua Holland. It's still Politics and Reality Radio. And I'm always pleased to be joined by my next guest. Roy Adroso is an OG blogger at the Aliki blog, and he covers the right blogosphere for The Village Voice. Roy, welcome back.
Thanks a lot. I'm going to correct you this time.
Okay.
It's, it's pronounced Aliku blog.
Aliku blog. You know what? I went back and forth about this. I've read it for 15 years. What does it mean? What does that come from?
Well, I used to write for an online journal called Alakubi. Alakubi means somewhere, and it's kind of an existential somewhere in Latin. And we put a blog on it. It was called Aliku Blog. Ha ha. And we you know, we survived. The body died, but the head lived on. So, so that's where we are.
God, such a smarty pants.
Well, I wanted to clear that up in case future generations want to know what was really going on.
All right, give it to me again.
Aliku blog.
Aliku blog.
Aliku blog. Aliku blog.
And what's the URL?
The URL is alikublog.blogspot.com. I've been meaning to correct that. I've been wanting to like bring it onto the mothership at my own website, but you know, it's amazing. As the technology for putting blogs and other websites together has gotten more advanced and allegedly easier. It actually takes a hell of a lot of information and time to actually do it right. It's like once upon a time, it's kind of like, oh, here's my crummy blog. You know, it's terrific. There it is. I put it up in 5 seconds and people come and read it. Now, if you want to put together a website, it takes close to forever. But anyway, this wasn't what you wanted to talk to me about. You wanted to talk about politics.
Yeah, I do. I do. Are you feeling stressed out about the election, or just the fact that a Trump administration would be so great for like liberal bloggers give you a sense of peace that the rest of us don't have?
That's one way of looking at it. Well, you know what? Every once in a while, if I begin to get stressed, I stop and think, what are elections in the United States like? Presidential elections particularly. Because, you know, you look back 4 years ago and the temperature of the blogosphere and, of course, commentary in any medium, newspaper, TV, whatever, is always a little bit jacked up, you know? So when I go back and look at what's going on now and I see all these people grabbing onto things like Hillary coughing, for example, Hillary having pneumonia, Hillary having a body double, this is the sort of thing that's just sort of simmering under the surface most of the year. There's just like a group of angry nuts under the bridge.
Right.
Like trading stories, you know, she's got mononucleosis plus Parkinson's, whatever it is. And you know, that kind of thing goes on all the time, and most people don't see it because they're all in their little warren. But, you know, we come to a presidential election like less than 60 days out, and suddenly it's in the newspapers, it's on television. You know, I saw this thing, I think I wrote about it, you may have seen it, where they're on The Hill, which is, you know, an estimable Washington publication. They had some doctor in Texas talk, you know, not just a crazy right-wing blogger type of guy, but a doctor in Texas talking about how he saw Hillary on TV and he's deduced that she has some kind of brain injury because of the way her eyes move. I'm not even – this is in The Hill. You know, it's not like in like Hi, I'm Crazy Weekly. This is
– So, is there a dynamic here where there's an endless supply of nonsense from like Jim Hoft type – Jim Hoff, known as the dumbest man on the internet.
And well-deserved, too, yeah.
And then there's this great demand caused by the presidential election where they need to fill column spaces. So they're like, okay, let's find some crazy doctor in Texas to write about Hillary Clinton's eye movements.
You know, I think you're onto something there. It's partly a supply and demand issue. It's kind of like, well, it's 90 days to the election. Let's go into the rat bag and see what crazy things we have. But it's also, too, I think everybody kind of feels it. I mean, there are some people who are blissfully unaware of everything. But, you know, I think most people have begun to think, wow, some kind of really momentous thing is coming down. You know, whatever happens, it's going to be a slightly different world. I mean, of course, Zog will still be ruling everything.
Yeah, of course.
But you know, but the face of Zog will either be, as one guy put it somewhere, Grandma Nixon or the Orange Hitler. So that makes a huge difference to some of us. So, but I think a lot of people at least are aware of that. And that's part of the reason why they've been pulling that's part of the reason why the media has been so happy with Trump in a way. I mean, everybody talks about how, yeah, the media made Trump because he's a mediagenic figure and they love covering people like that. They get a lot of hits and they get a lot of clicks. But also one of the things they really like about him is that he makes people nervous. It's not just that there are people who like him. I don't know why, but they do. But it's like the people who don't like them are every bit as interested.
Yes.
So you know, like I'll like read stories about Trump reflexively just like anybody else, not because I want to know like what brilliant policy he's come up with, but because like I know the guy might be running a large part of our lives in a little while, and I want to know like just how crazy he is.
Well, I mean, it's the same dynamic. You can't pull your eyes away from a car wreck, even if there's mangled bodies and, you know.
And the mangled body's happy to be your fellow. The mangled body's America.
I mean, look, fiction writers, everybody loves conflict. Conflict is what makes a story interesting. That's what gives the arc to a story is conflict. People don't understand how difficult it is, I think, when you have to write regularly about politics to come up with something to write about. When you do this as a full-time job, as I do, you know, there's a lot of we make fun of the media grasping onto silliness, overt silliness, but there's a lot of very subtle waste of intellectual space. You know, when you look at this election, it's been pretty consistent. Like, Hillary Clinton has enjoyed a lead that is somewhere twice the margin of Obama's lead over Mitt Romney for the entire time, right? She was ahead last year, and she was ahead 9 months ago, and she was ahead 6 months ago and 3 months ago. She's ahead today. And yes, the margin has waned and waxed, but it's been pretty, structurally, it's been pretty constant, you know, and yet we have to write about, you know, millennials are freaked out, or Latinos are, you know, not going to be sufficiently motivated, or whatever it is, you know, we have to find things to write about. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge to fill column spaces, you know?
Well, you know, I understand that, but I know that when you write about it, you don't feel it that way. You don't feel like, oh, the idiots are looking for more stuff about the election. Let's talk about, you know, Latvian tap dancers. I know that your feeling is, wow, the Latvian tap dancers, they're small but significant, you know. But it's like, so, you know, you're actually genuinely interested. And I think that's part of what goes on in internet media that people may not pick up on, even though everybody who works on the internet, including people who are complete amateurs, share in it, which is people do it because they're excited by it. And their level of excitement is not only pushed by supply and demand, as you've posited it, but it's also pushed by the fact that they too are really, it's like mass hysteria, basically. We all get very interested. And so small things, just like being terrified in the night and you hear a small sound, whoa, what was that? It could be anything. And that's kind of what this is like. It's kind of like, what happened with the Latvian tap dancers? That could be the break in the. I mean, because so many of these stories, you've noticed it too, probably have a little line that's like, this could be big.
Yes.
Or this is a game changer.
Is this going to be the October surprise? I mean, every year we have this thing about the October surprise. It's never actually materialized, right?
Not since 1980, no.
Right.
That was a real surprise.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, I was just talking to my wife about this. I said, you know, nothing has a shorter shelf life than, you know, received opinion. I was looking at an Adam Gopnik thing from The New Yorker, and it was from, I think, June, where he's talking about Trump, and he said a lot of the same things everybody always says about Trump, about he's dangerous, blah, blah, blah. But he was also, like, ragging on Bernie Sanders for enabling him. And it's kind of like, are you joking? Bernie Sanders, but like now, of course, we're like running for our lives. Bernie Sanders is way in the rearview mirror. How can you possibly be talking about, like, well, you know, when we look back on this election, it'll be Bernie Sanders who gave us Trump. It's like, what? Are you kidding?
Yeah, that is, I mean, well, the laziest type of punditry, and I think this is just to fill, when you need to fill a column space, is finding common threads between disparate events and mm-hmm. and disparate things that are complex in their own right. So, you know, you'll see these columns. It's like, okay, well, Brexit and Donald Trump and mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders are all part of the same, like, uprising against the establishment. And it's like, well, you know, you could say that Brexit and Trump, there are common themes of, you know, white ethno-nationalists rising up against, sure. right, perceived loss of power. But where do you bring Bernie Sanders into it? His like, let's do free college. Like, how does that work into that? You're shoehorning things into, you know, okay, he's not...
Well, that's because these are liberal arts graduates who've learned to make connections like that, and it's valid. You know, it's a great skill, but the thing is, you can go too far with it. I mean, it's not as if everyone in the world gets together in a pub/tavern/beer hall somewhere and says, hello, mate, you're from Germany, I see. What are you, oh, well, you know, this Hitler will be the end of us, mark my words. It's not like we all get together and talk about these things. There is not that much actual commonality between us and the people of Britain. It's not like, you know, well, you know, I was going for that Hillary Clinton, but then I saw how Brussels is putting the iron. Nobody does. Come on, we keep forgetting that there are real people out there who share maybe a thumbnail's worth of our concerns.
Yes.
So the food and shelter and, you know, my hatred of some particular minority. Yeah. Like, you know, but other than that, I mean, if you talk to them about Brexit, it's kind of like they think it's something at the Denny's, you know, it's like the Grand Slam. I had me a Brexit with that.
So speaking of common prejudices, Donald Trump finally kind of sort of disavowed birtherism, and he did it in such a classic grifter Don Trump fashion. He held this much ballyhooed press conference. He said two sentences about the topic and then tried to take the pool cameras on a tour of his crappy new hotel in D.C. He was like, no reporters, but I'll take the cameras to show you the Venetian whatever, right? The classic gold leaf. toilet seats. So, Roy, he's been one of the biggest advocates of birtherism for years and years and years. How did the kind of right blogger brethren respond to this?
Oh, well, I wrote about this at The Voice. I mean, it was kind of like, yeah, because he pushed it off on Hillary Clinton. Yeah. This is an ancient story. I mean, I wrote about this years ago, you know, where you'd see it bubbling up. Because, well, you know, Sid Blumenthal wrote an email, this kind of thing. But, you know, most of the time they wouldn't do much with it because it's kind of like when people are licking their wounds and say, well, you know, Martin Luther King was a womanizer. Right. It's that kind of story that you tell yourself, but it's not for general consumption. Right. When Trump went out in front of people and said, well, Hillary started it, all of these guys came up and said, yes, that's exactly right. I've been trying to tell you people. And, you know, they went on and on about it. Now, if any normal people read their stuff, they would probably react the same way most people, which is, why would Hillary Clinton do that? Now, there is a little window through which you can push that, which is that Hillary Clinton was running against Barack Obama in 2008. Everybody knows, because they've been told it insistently for years and years, that Hillary Clinton is corrupt and will do anything and killed Vince Foster and Kathleen Willey's cat and everybody else. So it's conceivable by that vision of Hillary Clinton that she would do something like spread that story about Obama. So most of the people who are hearing this stuff are probably thinking, well, you know, I guess she's pretty foxy. Maybe she would have done something like that and then let it go like that. You know, there are still a few deranged people who are kind of like, yes, that's exactly right. That's why Obama never became president. We're living in an alternate reality. It's like, and he made her Secretary of State because he appreciated, he being evil too, appreciated her evil genius. That's why he hired her, even though she was telling everybody allegedly that he was like born in Kenya. He said, no.
Remember there was that brief time when they were like, Obama encouraged this to make us look bad.
Oh, well, yeah.
To make us look crazy.
I mean, it was just stated again that, that was something different, but. Yeah, of course, the Obama is the original birther sort of thing. Yeah, I wrote about that too. I mean, and they'll still bring it up from time to time. They love to blame Obama for everything. I was just looking at a Jonah Goldberg column from about a week ago where, and again, that poor man. I mean, because I think he's been kind of kicked in the gut. More than the people who are like suffering from Ted Cruz having let them down by, you know, by saying that the man who basically said his wife was ugly and his father was like a murderer was actually, you know, the guy he wanted to have as president. But more than that, they're crippled by the fact that they said once upon a time that they would never back Trump, and everybody around them who said, yeah, that's the principled stand, way to go, we're with you, is folding like a bag of
cheap suit.
Like a cheap suit. And so Jonah Goldberg did this column about, well, you know, Obama really gave us Trump. And the thing is, that's a story I remember hearing way back at the beginning of this whole mess. Last year, John Fund at the National Review did a column called Donald Trump, double agent of the left, ? You know, that was their whole thing. It was kind of like, well, he's really a liberal. They would really love it if he became. Of course, now he's running against Hillary Clinton. Nobody believes that liberals want Donald Trump to be president. So, but Goldberg did this column and said, well, you know, by trawling the – well, actually, I can open it if I've got it. Yeah. The success of Obama's trolling may have Trump as its legacy is the Goldberg story. And he went on and on about how – he's been trolling the Republicans for a long time, which is true. Obama likes to stir it up a little bit, and he's, and people recognize it. But then Goldberg writes, Obama played a similar game with his birth certificate and the whole birther craze. He could have released his birth certificate as early as 2008. I'll sidebar here. He did. That was the short form one. Back to Goldberg, when the Mephistophelian Clinton henchman Sid Blumenthal was whispering in reporters' ears. Now, what he was probably whispering is like, we're going to get a drink around here, but you know.
No. So Sidney Blumenthal, who, and this is such a typical thing, he was like forwarding damaging stories about Barack Obama. He was forwarding this stuff to reporters, and everybody knew it, and this is not particularly like dirty pool, oh my God, forwarding emails like stories that are out there. So he promoted the rescue thing, and he might have actually forwarded something about some birther thing. He might have forwarded that on. The idea that they generated this, or that Sidney Blumenthal was acting as an official, you know, member of the campaign, it's just silly. And it's been debunked by every fact checker in the world. That doesn't make it go away. It's a zombie lie.
Well, the thing is, you have to actually look at what actually happened, which is maybe some guy in the campaign pushed this story, and then years and years of conservatives screaming about his birth certificate.
Yeah.
You have to weigh this. But anyway, I'll continue with the Goldberg story here. So he says after that, but Obama didn't, that is, release his birth certificate for years. In part because he knew the conspiracy theory would galvanize his base. I'm reading it off his column. It not only confirmed everything liberals wanted to hear about the right, it also provided Obama with an endless supply of one-liners. And for a long time, that worked well for Obama. He got to mock birthers and play the dignified victim. But you can probably already see the problem. When you throw out so many buckets of chum, you have no idea what kind of creatures you'll attract. And Obama chummed the waters for so long, he pulled in a great white shark, which is what he's talking about, Trump. So the whole crazy idea is that, you know, we didn't summon Trump. I mean, we were just standing here minding our own business, talking about Obama's birth certificate and how Hillary Clinton killed Vince Foster, and about how, you know, black people are trying to destabilize all this stuff, when suddenly this guy Trump shows up and he starts saying this crazy stuff.
We were just standing around being not racist.
Yeah, we were just standing around
and
like
suddenly they called us racist, and that made us racially resentment. That
right.
That built within us a lot of racial resentment.
Right, and somebody's got to be to blame for that, and you know, it's got to be Obama. He does everything. He's like Dr. Mabuza in those old Fritz Lang movies.
Well, I will say this, Roy. There were reports that Bill Clinton encouraged Donald Trump to get into the race, and it's not the dumbest idea they've ever had.
No, well, at least it's a good story, you know, and it's all stories. I mean, you're capable of believing it if you can believe that, like a doctor in Texas watching his TV can diagnose brain damage in Hillary Clinton by the way she moves her eyes. You know, then God go with you.
I want him to be a podiatrist, a Texas podiatrist.
Well, a lot of these guys, they don't even have that. I mean, the guy on in the Hill, the guy, he actually said, no, I'm not a neurologist. It's funny because I had just been to the doctor that week, and I was talking to a urology guy about an endocrine issue. And he said, well, I don't want to, like, you know, that's because that's normally what they do. It's like, look, we have different specialties. There's a reason for that. And then, you know, you see this guy in Texas is saying, well, you know, it's not my area, but I've done a lot of reading and studying on my own.
Roy and Joe, so I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week. I really appreciate it.
Always, Josh. Have a beautiful day.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with Heather Digby Parton.
Ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien, non, je ne regrette rien. c'est payé, balayé, oublié. Je me fous du passé avec mes souvenirs. J'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs. Je n'ai plus besoin de balayer les amours. Avec leur trémolo, balayé pour toujours, je repars à zéro. Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien, ni le bien.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by one of our favorite regulars on the show, Heather Parton, who you may know as Digby, writes a column at Salon, and of course is the proprietor of
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Heather, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hey.
It's Old School Bloggers Week. We just spoke with Roy Adroso from I Like You Blog, and you two are among the last
Absolutely.
True,
yeah, I think he even started before standing. me, which is a long time ago. Oh, I know.
Wow,
we
I
were
know
just
the
young
internet
little
went back
whippersnappers
that far.
At the time. Oh, God.
How are you holding up, Heather? I've kind of sensed a rising
yes,
level
well,
of
you know,
frustration
I mean,
in your writing.
Can you blame me?
I have to tell you.
This has been, you know, this has been a tough election.
I cannot.
To, you know, to keep your equanimity, and it is getting closer, and the race is close, and that's, you know, always a tough situation in any election, but in this one, it makes me feel a little frantic because Donald Trump is, you know, really for me, the first time in my life and that I've ever, you know, truly, truly feared an election. And the election of a particular person that I really thought that it could be catastrophic.
You know, I a few times I've gone back and I've thought Mitt Romney was pretty benign. Like I wouldn't have felt.
I mean, I don't think I've never had that feeling that the Republic was threatened. I was, you know, obviously, I mean, there have been many, I mean, I'm old, so I've been through a lot of these. When Reagan was running, you know, I was, and I had been living in California, so I'd been, you know, I was aware of his you know, style and how incredibly appealing he could be, even as he was, you know, standing for and pushing policies that were just completely, you know, horrifying in my view. And I did worry, you know, those Cold War, there were a lot of, the stakes were high and you always wondered what was going to happen. But even that, I never felt this way. I mean, you know, Donald Trump he is unique and he is something, I don't think he's controllable. Even if, you know, it's not like George W. Bush where you always felt like, well, there's got to be a bunch of, you know, old guards standing around him. As it turned out, they were all psychos, but nonetheless. Yeah, exactly. But, you know,
right,
there wasn't
the
this sense
of, yeah,
of, just,
I mean, was,
of complete,
pretty terrifying.
You know, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I have this vision of the morning after the election. And my feeling is that if he wins, the world has completely changed overnight. And that's just because of the national security side of this. I think that the world will think that the world's only superpower, the United States, has gone rogue. And I think that changes everything.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how people in other countries would regard that. But I have to tell you this, and I mentioned this to Roy. You know, I know Trump could win, and that's terrifying. But so far, everything looks like it's proceeding toward a Clinton win. She has not trailed for even one day in four of the five big polling averages, right? Real Clear Politics had Trump up for a day or two right after the convention, and the rest have had him behind for the entire time, right?
It is.
And it's tough for a party to hang on to the White House for three terms. Clinton has a ton of baggage, both real and imagined, and yet she's maintained a lead that's been roughly twice the size of the one Obama enjoyed over Mitt Romney. Yet every story we read seems to be Democrats worrying about this or that, or, you know, why can't Hillary connect with this or that group? Is it possible that Hillary Clinton's just running a solid campaign and our view is kind of clouded by the fact that Trump is this toxic clown who we feel
absolutely. I mean, it's a really good point because, I mean, you can look at this from any number of perspectives, but here's one to look at. As you pointed out, the third term, I think somebody said on somewhere the other day pointed out that it had been James Monroe was the last Democrat to have actually accomplished this particular thing, a third term in the Democratic administration, other than Franklin Roosevelt, obviously. Someone who succeeded, successor.
Successor.
It's also, we're coming out of an epic economic crisis, which people are only now starting to begin to feel, if not, the reality has been we've been in recovery for some time, but it's been slow, it's been painful, it's been erratic, and people are only starting to feel that. That's a very, very difficult headwind for anyone to be running, especially one who's running after 8 years of a policy that many people feel has not delivered for them yet. So that's a problem. And then you've got the fact that she's a woman, which is clearly, a problem. I don't think, maybe people want to deny that, but of course, I don't think that that's true. And I think that particularly on the right, there's a sense that somehow or another, the Democrats keep forcing the country to, take people who don't deserve to be president. First, it was an African American. Now, then 8 years of that hell, and now they're bringing a woman on here. What the hell is going on? So there's a sense of, that there have been a million articles written about the sense of alienation among a certain group of white people in this country. And then, finally, there's the fact that she's running against an alien from another planet. And I think any campaign would have a problem. There's no rule book for this. There's no playbook for running against Donald Trump. Everything is different. I mean, all you have to do is look at what happened in the GOP primary with 17 Republican all-stars. All of them fell one by one because they couldn't figure out, in hindsight, you can see things they should have done. But at the time, I'm sure they all thought they were, doing the right thing. And yet nothing worked. So, I think that they were. But, there's 17 of them. You would have thought one of them could have knocked this guy off if it was that easy, right? I mean, if this guy's just so.
Yeah.
Of course.
Well, the fact that it was fractured, though, that helped him a lot. He did not win a majority of primary mm-hmm. votes, which, Mitt Romney did. Mitt Romney won 51% or something like that. He needed that fractured field to get him into the nomination. But listen, on Monday, we're going to have a potentially big day in this campaign. The first debate, first of three. And here's some counter conventional wisdom to think about. The conventional wisdom is that debates don't have much impact on a race, right? There have been, I guess, a few moments historically that people point to and say, well, back in 1962, whatever, the first televised debate. But for the most part, they don't move the needle. So this election cycle, we're seeing kind of a counter conventional wisdom come that this year may be different. Trump could show himself to be, on the one hand, he could show himself to be presidential and knowledgeable and prepared in front of a huge national audience. And that performance and the media coverage that would follow it could, allay the concerns of some Republicans. Or it could be an emperor has no clothes moment. I think this is more likely, where Hillary Clinton just kind of dances circles around him and baits him into childish attacks and exposes his profound ignorance of the world. Or maybe she'll have a coughing fit, right? And the media will obsess over that for a week. But what if What if it, I'll offer the counter conventional wisdom would be, no, these two have super high name recognition. The public knows who they are. Everybody has taken sides for the most part. And the race, the structure of the race is basically set. Nothing will change.
Well, you know, I don't, I agree with you that I think that a lot of times, you know, these debates are oversold as major events. I mean, they are events. People tend to tune in. And this year they're expecting that there's going to be a higher than normal level for all the reasons that you described. People are feel like they might see something, you know, exciting, I think, happen. You know, Trump could get mad and call her crooked Hillary to her face, or Hillary could collapse, or, you know, something could happen that could make it really an event that you'd want to witness. Because I don't think people really love debate. You know, the vast majority of people love the debates, you know, for their own sake. But you know, aside from that, I kind of suspect that you're right. I mean, it just, when you look back at the polling numbers, and I hate horse race talk, but it's you can't help it in a race that's this close. You kind of have to pay attention. It's really been stable. It's, you know, it has been stable. And there are these moments, like after the conventions, there was a big bounce for Hillary, and then she came back. And, you know, Trump has had his moments as well. And you know, that things on the margins, it seems to be affected for a while. But for the most part, this race has been really quite stable going all the way along. And she's ahead. And she's ahead by, you know, a handful of points. I mean, it's not, you know, we don't have landslides in America anymore, that we're too polarized. It's highly unlikely that we'll ever see, you know, a Reagan 84, for instance, again, or at least not in any time soon. So, you know, I mean, even Obama in 2008, who had a very decisive and exciting win, it wasn't a landslide, you know, by those old standards. So, you know, I mean, we can't, you know, If this is the way the race is, and what you say is correct, that we've pretty much, you know, everybody's taken up sides. There's a certain, I mean, most of the race was decided probably before either of these candidates actually declared. You know, this was the partisan makeup of the country, and this is the way it is. And you've got, you know, most independents lean one way or the other. You know, then it's unlikely that. That a debate, something like that. I mean, this is, seems to be more of, it's like the big, you know, the wrestling championship of the campaign that we've been leading up to, rather than maybe a significant mover. I just don't know what either of them could do other than, you know, something totally uncharacteristic. I mean, if Donald Trump showed up and he had mastered the, you know, he just seemed like he was a policy wonk like you've never seen before. He put Hillary in the ground with his, you know, policy acumen. I think that would shock people enough that maybe they'd go, wow, maybe I should vote for this guy. He's been hiding this whole time. But I think the odds of that happening are not very high. I think that's something from a fantasy land, a bizarro world. debate that we're unlikely to see. And she's unlikely to, I think, to you know, fold or burst into tears or whatever it is that people think about her. She's not that kind of a person. She's pretty solid, I think.
I think you're right about that. And it's an interesting period because we're seeing a lot of spin as far as managing expectations, a lot of leaks, strategic leaks. Mm-hmm. The Trump team is saying that he isn't prepping for the debate in any traditional sense. And I think that they're trying to make the bar so low, set the bar so low that he can't help but go over it, in terms of, you know, this sense that he's not a politician like she is, and he's not even cramming to try to meet her on her own terms. So we'll see if that is an effective strategy. Heather, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me this week. I believe we are out of time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Joshua.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to look at something completely different, climate change, which is, you know, something we should pay attention to.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. And I know, I know, I know, I know. Sunshine when she's gone, only darkness every day. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away, anytime she goes away.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by David Turnbull. David is the campaign director for Oil Change International. It's an organization that exposes the true price of our reliance on fossil fuels. And that price includes the hidden costs, right? And that goes beyond just subsidies that governments dole out or the public costs of providing security to private oil companies. It also includes the so-called externalities, those healthcare costs, infrastructure costs, and of course the big one, the costs in blood and treasure that we'll see with catastrophic climate disruption. David, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
I invited David to come on the show this week to talk about a new report his group put out. It is titled "The Sky's the Limit, Why the Paris Climate Goals Require a Managed Decline of Fossil Fuel Production." And you can read the whole thing at priceofoil.org, all one word. David, how does this report relate to the Paris climate deal struck last year?
So this report looks at the goals that are in the Paris Climate Agreement to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius and aiming for 1.5 degrees Celsius. And then it compares that to the existing fossil fuel projects that are currently in place around the world. And when you look at those projects, what we have found is that the carbon, the fossil fuels that are dug up, if those projects continue to be done, that carbon will take us past the goals of what the Paris Agreement put in place. In other words, if we let all of the projects for fossil fuels around the world continue to the end of their lifespan, we won't meet the goals that the Paris Agreement put forth.
Okay, so in Paris, we had commitments from like 190-something countries to keep warming at or below 2 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial temperatures. And then there's this so-called ratchet principle where the world is supposed to come together and strengthen their commitments every 5 years. Those that didn't hit their targets, I guess, would be publicly shamed. And the idea is to get temperatures down to less than 1.5 degrees Celsius. So, David, when you talk about existing projects, you're talking about where they've already invested in infrastructure, drilling infrastructure, transport infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. You're not talking about proven reserves, right?
That's right. Previous studies looked at those proven reserves and made the conclusion that 80% of proven reserves need to stay in the ground. What we've done is gone further and looked at those projects that already have investments in place. They have equipment on the ground. There are pipelines being built. Those are the projects that fossil fuel companies already have invested in.
And I mean, obviously, this is a more challenging political lift because you're saying not only do you need to leave the fuel in the ground that you've discovered, but you actually have to stop production where you've already started production and invested money. Let me ask you this, David. What might the difference look like between holding temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius and 2 degrees Celsius below, compared to pre-industrial temperatures? What would that look like in terms of long-term environmental damage? I mean, is there a huge difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees?
There is. We are already seeing at roughly 1 degree of warming major impacts around the world every day. So every half a degree of warming that we're seeing out there really does make a big difference. You know, when I look at the calls for staying to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we see those from the most vulnerable countries around the world, the small island states who might be inundated and literally cease to exist if the sea levels rise, the countries in Africa that are dealing with famine and drought and really serious impacts already. Those are the countries that call for 1.5 degrees. And it was a really big achievement to see the rest of the world join that call in Paris. The difference between staying below 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees could actually be the very existence of some small island countries, for instance.
And this kind of brings us to a key issue that had to be overcome in Paris, and that's really been dogging the effort to strike a climate deal for years, which is this divide between wealthier countries that got rich emitting a lot of greenhouse gases, and then poorer countries that did not. And as you note, many of them bear the worst brunt of the changing environment. How do we address those disparities?
Well, you know, it's a really big challenge. And the first part of that is really providing support to the countries that need it to both adapt to the impacts that they're seeing, but also to help them move forward in a cleaner pathway, not repeat the mistakes that the rich countries have done, to help them develop, provide clean energy access to their communities and citizens in a way that can help move us away from fossil fuels. You know, our report has shown that we need to stop digging now everywhere, and that the rich countries around the world can really lead the way by stopping any sort of new development of fossil fuels, but by also entering into a real robust effort to support countries around the world to do the same.
And my understanding is that a lot of these countries are desperate for cleaner energy technologies. They don't actually want to follow in our footsteps if they have the option not to. So let's say we halt production. How do we make up for that energy we have to leave in the ground? Are we at the point with renewables where we have the capacity to make up that difference right away? Or what kind of time frame are we talking about?
So, you know, this report and none of us are calling for an end to fossil fuel use tomorrow, overnight. We're not calling for that. That's not the expectation. But what we do see is that the uptake of renewables, the increasing availability, the decreasing price of renewables is moving in such a fast pace that it can replace the fossil fuels as we phase them out. Now, we need to do that in the next, say, 25 years, by the middle of the century, something along those lines, in order to really have a shot at staying below 2 degrees Celsius. And of course, if we want to move closer to that more safer 1.5 degrees Celsius, we need to do that even more quickly. Our report cites a number of different studies out there that show that there are pathways to seeing renewable energy take the place of fossil fuels in that time frame. It's doable. It's a big effort. It's a very big challenge, but there are a number of people, a number of studies out there that say it can be done. It just really requires a concerted effort from governments around the world.
And it really must be done. It's not that we have a choice. We have a choice of waiting until we see the worst effects of it or not waiting until we see the worst effects of it. So related to that discussion, the report talks about a managed decline in fossil fuel usage, and a, quote, just transition. And I found that interesting. What does a just transition look like in the real world?
So this concept of a just transition really comes from the labor movement, the labor movement of unions and trade workers around the world that see climate as an important critical issue to be addressed, but also want to be sure that workers are protected as we move in that transition. So a just transition is about social protections, it's about job retraining, it's about finding ways to ensure that those people who are currently employed in the fossil fuel industry or communities that are dependent on the revenues from the fossil fuel industry are protected and really lifted up and brought along as we move towards a clean energy economy. So there's a lot of different ideas out there, a lot of really, really important proposals from labor unions and other academics and folks that have looked at it closely. These include, as I said, training programs. It includes job placement programs and other investments to be sure that these communities are protected. And that's critical because, you know, we don't want to continue to make the mistakes of the fossil fuel industry in benefiting some people, but not all people. We want to ensure that as we move towards a clean energy economy, everyone benefits from it. Everyone is brought along and people are lifted up out of poverty, out of challenging circumstances.
And I think it's a really crucial point because very often, you know, the environmental movement had said, well, look, we will have a plethora of new jobs, we'll have a green economy, all these people will be needed to install new solar and wind power, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to pay attention to the transition for the people who are skilled up for the oil industry, for the gas industry, for the coal industry. They're not magically going to be retrained and relocated to where renewable energy is providing jobs. That has to be something that is done with a certain amount of care and coordination. It's not going to happen by itself. So let me ask you to leave on a positive note. The good news, according to the report, is that there is already progress towards stopping new fossil fuel development. Tell us where we're at in this area. What good news can we look at?
Well, I think the good news is really looking around at communities that are already standing up against really problematic fossil fuel projects. We have a burgeoning keep it in the ground movement here in the US that is standing up all across the country. And that's a part of a global movement to really stand up around the world. We view that this report that we've just put out really puts some serious analytical math and substance behind what we already sort of intrinsically knew, which is that we need to stop digging. We need to move in a new direction. And so where I see inspiration and excitement is the fact that communities all around the country are standing up in brave, bold, and powerful ways to stand up and say no more fossil fuel infrastructure. And we hope that this report can give even more fuel to that fire.
And I should note that the report, when it says that the existing infrastructure, the existing projects would bring us beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius, that doesn't include coal. That's just gas and oil. David Turnbull, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Folks, the report is called The Sky's the Limit, Why the Paris Climate Goals Require a Managed Decline of Fossil Fuel Production. And you can read the whole thing at priceofoil.org. I'd also like to thank Roy Odroso and Heather Digby-Parton. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. You can also send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank Digby again for allowing me to host the show at her place. Same goes for Crooks and Liars. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. My love is you. Some men replace their mamas and